Welcome to Footnotes, a podcast by the Sydney University Law Society, sponsored by Gilbert and Tobin. I'm Lou, your host for this episode. Chances are, when you think what life was like between the ages of 10 and 13 years old, you don't think about being in handcuffs, court, or a prison cell. For hundreds of children in Australia, this is their reality. The recent Raise the Age campaign, spearheaded by legal experts, doctors, and justice groups, aimed to raise the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 14, to bring Australia in line with many of the jurisdictions around the world, and to stop kids from being locked up. In this episode of Footnotes, we delve into Australia's current policy regarding the age of criminal responsibility. Have a look at the backgrounds of the kids who are ending up in prison because of it, and also discuss potential alternatives to the current practice of youth incarceration. We were also lucky enough to speak to Sydney University Associate Professor Garner Clancy, an expert in criminology, who spoke to us about his experience working with young people in detention and in community rehabilitation, as well as his thoughts on the current age of criminal responsibility in Australia. Once again, welcome to Footnotes, a legal podcast run by students for students, breaking down the complex legal industry one chat at a time, sponsored by Gilbert and Tobin. To understand why there is a debate in the first place, we first need to understand the concept of the age of criminal responsibility. David will be taking us through the issues. Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Lou. It's good to be here.
Now, the age of criminal responsibility, what does that actually refer to?
Well, basically, the minimum age of criminal responsibility as a threshold below which you simply cannot, by definition, commit a crime. So, essentially, in New South Wales, there is what we call a conclusive presumption that a child under the age of 10 cannot be guilty of any offence of any criminal proceeding under, and that's from Section 5 of the Children Criminal Proceedings Act 1987. So if you really want to take it out on someone you don't like, do it before you turn 10 years old.
Wow, too late for me, I suppose. Great. And what about the federal system? Is that the same or?
Sure. The age is the same. The wording is a little bit different. It just says that a child under 10 cannot be liable, quote, for an offence against a law of the Commonwealth. And that's Section 4M of the Crimes Act 1914. And they are not, quote, criminally responsible. And that's from Section 7.1 of the Commonwealth Criminal Code.
Okay. So in New South Wales and the federal system, it's 10. What about the rest of Australia? Is that sort of the same or any differences?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the same. It's the minimum age of criminal responsibility across all Australian states and territories is 10 years old. Although, if you think 10's a bit young to be put in jail, you should see Tasmania and the ACT in the 1990s. They had a criminal responsibility age of 8 and 7 years old, respectively.
Yeah, right. So things have always been a bit different in Tasmania, it's fair to say.
If there are any Tasmanian listeners out there, we love you, but we have to make these jokes. Sorry.
Come on, guys, get it together.
The good thing is the ACT has taken a step in the right direction, and they're proposing that after the state election in October, they're going to amend the minimum age to 14 years old. So.
Okay, so that's the Australian context. What about internationally? Where do we measure up in that respect?
Well, unfortunately, we're a bit like the Tasmania of the world in this respect. So the worldwide median age of minimum criminal responsibility is 14 years old. So obviously we are noticeably lower.
It seems odd in some ways that Australia would be so behind the rest of the world. I mean, yeah. We're such a great country, forward-thinking country in so many other ways.
Absolutely.
Is there any sort of international law that plays in any of this? Any international norms that we're perhaps not in line with? Or
to the extent that there is such a thing as international law, I guess, and it's just not all make-believe, especially on this issue. I guess there is the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but under that convention, we have no binding obligation to be actually above any minimum age. So we're technically in the clear.
Yeah, right. So there is sort of an international encouragement or suggestion, but Australia's chosen not to follow that. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a norm, but we haven't conformed to that norm at all.
Okay, so do many other countries sort of have a higher threshold then?
Yeah, sure. So the top level thing is that the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child encourages all nation states to raise their minimum age to at least 14 years.
Mm.
For instance, most of our European buddies, so that's Germany, Italy, Spain, they've all got a minimum age of 14 years or higher. And we're only really joined in this respect by the United Kingdom, who's also got an age of 10. So
okay,
we're kind of on an island in terms of how the rest of the world treats this issue.
Okay.
Aside from good old Great Britain.
Good old Britain. Right, well, I mean, our Queen does live there. Thanks so much for the intro, David.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Brandon will be taking us through the youth justice system and discussing the causes and underlying factors that lead to young people becoming offenders. Hi, Brandon. Great to have you with us. How's it going?
Good, Lou. How are you?
Good, thanks. Now, Brandon, let's get started. Youth justice system. Can you tell us some numbers about who's in there?
Sure. So, in essence, how we sort of divide up the youth justice system is between both sentenced and unsentenced, as well as those in detention and those not in detention. Where not in detention can mean sort of like community service or community sort of vigilance. And so we can look at these numbers and look at those who are in detention, as well as those who are unsentenced and sentenced inside detention. So in 2018, data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare found that on an average day in Australia, 910 youths were in detention.
Wow.
And detention doesn't necessarily mean they're guilty and serving time, as I just mentioned. In fact, another AOHW report this year found that 63% of young people in detention on average day were unsentenced.
Wow, so they haven't even been convicted of anything.
That's right. So that 63% are young people who have not been found guilty of the crime yet. They may be on something such as remand, or they may be arrested and awaiting a charge.
Yeah, right. That seems crazy to me that so many people are just there, you know, not even convicted yet, effectively being punished for something they may not even be found guilty of. Okay, so regarding all those kids who are locked up, not necessarily even convicted of anything, who are they? How'd they end up there? What are their backgrounds?
Yeah, unfortunately, with the criminal justice system at these young ends of the spectrum, we see the sort of common causes come up time and time again. So it's things like being in the child protection system, family dysfunction, poverty, and drug and alcohol abuse by parents as well as the children themselves that come up in these sort of risk factors, unfortunately. And we also, unfortunately, see Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders people majorly overrepresented in the youth part, as well as the general population.
Right. So it seems like in a lot of ways, these kids are sort of being punished for their backgrounds and for their upbringing, things that they can't really help.
Yeah. And I found this one sort of statistic that was quite concerning. There's this youth justice detention facility in Western Australia called Banksia Hill. It's actually the only youth detention facility in Western Australia. And it found that 9 out of 10 incarcerated youths had some form of neurodisability. And of the 99 people between the ages of 10 and 17 who completed a full assessment with these researchers, 36, or more than 1 in 3 of them, had FASD, which is fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, which is sort of an umbrella term for a variety of disorders that children can unfortunately be given because of their mother's alcohol use during pregnancy.
So it does sound to me that, like, as we said, a lot of these people can't really help the situation that they're in.
Yes, that's right. And other data found that young people under supervision were 9 times more likely than the rest of the juvenile population to be in child protection, with Indigenous youths 17 times more likely.
It does seem, from what you've said, it does seem like a system that's not probably not functioning the way it should, you know, leading these people into prisons and other sort of unfortunate situations, then they're sort of stuck there, you know. But the reality is some of these kids do commit, you know, really violent crimes. Should some of these kids perhaps be locked up, you know, for their own protection and also for the protection of the community?
Yeah, I think it would be denying the reality to say that some children do commit these sort of high-level crimes that the community think of as quite abhorrent, such as murder, manslaughter, and things like sexual offences. But when we look at the data, it's just not unsubstantiated, with particularly the lower end of our age of criminal responsibility, so those between 10 and 13, when they don't commit these crimes in such large numbers. Data from the 2018 to 2019 financial year collated by the Australian Bureau of Statistics found that there were no youths aged between 10 and 13 that were found guilty of homicide and related offences. And in the sexual assault and related offences category, only 304 out of the 1,356 offenders were aged between 10 and 13, and less than 30 people each aged between 10 and 11 years old were guilty of a crime related to sexual assault and the related offences. So to say that there is this sort of great crime problem that will occur if the age of criminal responsibility is sort of a bit...
Inaccurate.
Not true. Yes.
Okay, so you're basically saying that a lot of these kids who are locked up, they haven't committed violent crimes or very serious crimes. They're just sort of locked up for perhaps more minor offences, and then they're sort of brought into this system that it might be very difficult for them to get out of. Is that sort of...
Yeah, and I think that is right. And I think what the system needs for all of these children is they need to work more on diversionary programs that ensure that these crimes are not committed in the future, because unfortunately, as we've already discussed, this cycle can perpetuate when children are exposed to the criminal justice system. So having these diversionary programs and restorative justice for these more high-level offences is actually more effective.
So that'll be better, obviously, for the kids and probably better for the community as a whole as well.
That's right, because as will be mentioned a bit later, the costs of keeping kids in jail are just astronomical.
Brandon, thanks so much for your time. Good to know about the actual numbers and what's going on in the youth justice system. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In order for us to gain an insider perspective on this topic, Alana spoke to Associate Professor Garner Clancy, a criminology professor at the University of Sydney Law School. Alana spoke to the professor about his experiences working in youth detention and the justice system, as well as his thoughts on the current age of criminal responsibility in Australia.
Okay, well, I guess the first question is nice and easy. Could you please tell us your name and what you do?
Garner Clancy, I'm an Associate Professor of Criminology in the University of Sydney Law School.
And so what has your experience been working with young people in detention and rehabilitation?
Many years ago, so the early 90s, I worked in the youth justice system in New South Wales. I spent a number of years working in juvenile justice centres, as they were then known, both with young men and young women, young people on remand, young people on control orders, which meant they were serving periods of incarceration. I also worked in other areas of the youth justice system, including community-based supervision and restorative justice, and then worked for the New South Wales Police Force for 3.5 years in the Youth and Child Protection Team. In more recent years, I've been engaged by Youth Justice New South Wales to undertake a number of research projects, including a review of classification system for young people in custody, a review of funded services for community-based NGOs supporting young people on community-based supervision orders, and more recently looking at kind of the linguistic and speech requirements of young people passing through the youth justice system.
And so based on that array of experience, what do you see as the impact of detention on particularly 10 to 13-year-olds?
To summarise the impact of detention on 10 to 13-year-olds, I can say it in a word, bad. The emotional, physical and sort of social developmental differences between a 10-year-old and, a 17-year-old are really quite dramatic. So 10-year-olds are really quite vulnerable in detention, and that can be a concern for both their safety but also their worldview if they're associating with older, more sophisticated offenders and to try and fit in, they then kind of conform to the behaviour and expectations of older young people. So it can be really quite damaging for very young people to be in custody.
And so you've noted the distinction between a 10-year-old and a 17, 18-year-old. What do you think generally separates these younger criminal offenders from adult offenders?
There can be a myriad of differences between young offenders and adult offenders. Many of the young offenders we know as a result of research about their kind of health and social and emotional well-being have experienced a variety of forms of abuse and neglect. They've been victims of crime. So they're often incredibly vulnerable population who need often trauma-informed kind of practice and support around their mental health and their alcohol and other drug use. So generally speaking, the system seeks to rehabilitate young people where for adults the focus is much more on a kind of deterrence perspective. As an adult, you've more clearly chosen to behave in a criminal way, where for many young people that distinction is not so clear.
So does that deterrence factor still come into it?
There is a degree of deterrence. but it's not so much enshrined in legislation. It's more the process of coming into the system perhaps acts as a deterrent. But for many of the young people who repeat visitors to, say, youth justice centres, often their lives are so chaotic, detention doesn't really act as a deterrent. And in some cases, the reverse is true, that the idea of going into a facility where there's, a warm bed, three meals a day, and a general level of protection is actually quite appealing. So for some young people, being in detention is almost respite from life outside the walls, where their lives are often quite violent, quite chaotic, quite uncertain, often itinerant. So detention, at least for short periods, for some young people is desirable, sadly.
How is the judicial system, as it stands at the moment, promoting rehabilitation and trying to prevent recidivism?
So there are a series of steps that young people essentially move through, depending on their offending severity and the frequency of their offending. So there's a real emphasis on diversion. The first port of call that if a young person engages in a criminal activity, ideally they're diverted from the children's court. So that might be to a police caution or to a youth justice conference. And the emphasis on really not having them enter the system where they're often labelled as young offenders, associate with other young offenders. At that point, if they continue to offend, they then are likely to end up in the children's court, which has a heavy emphasis on rehabilitation. So there's an effort to try and provide community-based supervision, provide links to counselling services and other support mechanisms, try and encourage young people to be at school rather than out of school, in the hope that by building all of those protective factors around a young person, we reduce the risks that they're offending or reoffending.
And so, in your opinion, do you think that the current policy, as it stands, is successful in preventing young people from committing crimes and getting into the system?
It's a difficult question to say, does the current policy work in terms of preventing young people offending? Because there are a myriad of policies that really impact the likelihood of young people being involved in crime. And so we might look at the child protection system and cast a lens over that and say, is it working effectively? Well, there are lots of concerns about the number of young people who are in the out-of-home care system that have been removed from their families. Traditionally, they've often been overrepresented in detention. So there's some concerns about the impacts of the child protection system. There are questions to be asked of the education system about how well they engage children and young people in education, because that's obviously going to be a protective factor for young people. But generally speaking, I think it's important to say that youth crime in New South Wales, certainly in the last 10 years, has generally been declining, and the number of young people in custody has also diminished. So something seems to be working, whether that's associated with policies in New South Wales or some broader trends, because the trends in falls in youth crime appear to be across various countries, not just in New South Wales and Australia. So yes, there seems to be some things working, and yes, I think generally speaking, the emphasis on diversion and rehabilitation are really important and beneficial kind of twin policy objectives.
With the Raise the Age campaign that we've seen, there seems to be quite a lot of focus on the actual age for criminal responsibility at 10 years old and trying to increase that. So how would changing this age affect things from those multifaceted perspectives you were just looking at?
If the age was raised, I think the logic is that in a perfect world, welfare, child protection and other systems better respond to the needs of those young people, and we keep them out of a criminal justice system that can be stigmatising, that can result in labelling, that can result in a reduction of good connections in their lives. So if a young person ends up in a youth justice centre, then it can be very hard to get them back into school. They may have had a particular form of housing that gets disrupted, and they then may become homeless. They may lose contact with important people in their lives by virtue of their period of incarceration. So raising that age will both clear out of the system the very young kids and divert them into more of a welfare system, and it will slow their entry into the youth justice system. So I think the real concern is if a 10-year-old is appearing in a children's court, there's a very high likelihood that they will become entrenched in the youth justice system.
So what makes 14 years old this more appropriate minimum age?
I think there's some debate, to be honest, about what age it might get raised to. My sense is 14 is going to be a bit of a hard sell, that I'm not sure that particular communities are going to be all that happy with the idea that the minimum age of criminal responsibility gets increased to 14 years of age. What I think is probably a better middle ground is 12 years of age, so that you would clearly distinguish between primary school and high school. I think there's a logic to that in saying that by the time young people get to high school, they're more clearly, they've got greater insight, they understand their behaviours more. But that said, the notion of raising it to 14 is with the view of kind of understanding the vulnerability of children, and they are children, coming into contact with the system that can often be stigmatising, can be criminogenic. People have contact with the criminal justice system, often come back, and all of the good things that might be going on in their lives can be disrupted as a result of contact with the criminal justice system. And it forces the state to say, we need to take greater responsibility for the very young children who are involved in crime, and see that as almost a cry for help rather than as some sort of kind of malicious act on committed by, you know, a 10 or 11-year-old. And so that forces us to have a different policy response and think differently about those young people and almost construct their offending differently, which has happened in other parts of the world where it's a reflection on society if an 11-year-old is offending. It's not a reflection on that young person. And I think there's some value in trying to shift that kind of narrative and thinking in terms of responsibility for offending.
Has that been a subject of some of your research, those surrounding factors that could contribute to youth offending?
Broadly, yes. So I suppose my research, certainly for the last 15 or so years, has been really focused on the prevention of crime. So having started work at the back end of the youth justice system, it was very clear to me that the young people who ended up in detention had often had, you know, almost no opportunities in life. Their family situations were often dire. They often had kind of quite significant alcohol and other drug dependence problems, lots of self-harm and suicide ideation, and mental illness, and really kind of chaotic, disrupted lives. So the idea of incarcerating them seemed unhelpful to me, and so I got interested in thinking about how to prevent their entry into the system.
What have you identified in just like the high level summary of the key considerations for the development of effective crime prevention plans?
I think ultimately effective crime prevention policies and plans require, in the first instance, a emphasis on early intervention. So focus on how to support infants and families. We know that often problems emerge early in the life course. So doing programs involving nurses visiting young and first-time parents is a good way of supporting them and identifying if there are any problems. The provision of parenting training to kind of help and guide new parents, the provision of childcare and the kind of school enrichment programs to help young people, children or young people who are perhaps not performing so well. That's the kind of first important focus, early intervention. Then it's about ideally building strong communities. So how do we ensure that young people grow up in neighbourhoods where crime isn't rife, where they grow up in neighbourhoods where there are lots of positive opportunities for their development? So that involves community building, thinking about how we create community hubs so that there are a range of services that children, young people and their families can tap into, so that if they are experiencing difficulties, they know that there's help available. My fear is often that some young people don't really get the support they have been calling out for until they're in the youth justice system, and that's generally later than would be ideal. It would be ideal to have these sorts of services in communities and neighbourhoods for children, young people and their families to access.
So in light of that, would changing the age just be the band-aid solution?
Not necessarily a band-aid solution. I think there are multiple things always happening at once, and if we focus on any one area, it can often be to the neglect of others. So the raising the minimum age of criminal responsibility is just one dimension of a series of kind of policy levers. And there are a number of things that put in place. There's been lots of consideration about how best to keep children and young people in schools who are experiencing difficulties. There's lots of thinking about how to deliver programs to parents in kind of disadvantaged circumstances and the complexities of doing that, because some people don't want to be labelled as being potentially bad parents just because they come from a poor area. So there are lots of challenges about implementation and delivery of policies that I think often are neglected, that people say, oh, you know, we just need to do, you know, policy X. Well, that's easy to say. It's actually very hard to do in practice. The raising the minimum age of criminal responsibility is sort of an adjunct to all of those things. It just further helps us keep children and young people out of the criminal justice system, to allow them to mature, to allow them to get the types of services that we think are more likely to provide a supportive framework and to assist them to avoid future offending.
Yeah, no, it definitely sounds like a much more positive result. There's very little upside to just locking kids up.
Yeah, well, there's probably only one upside. I think there are schools in each of the youth justice centres, and the schools are phenomenal in my general experience. And for the first time ever, lots of kids in youth justice centres learn. Their reading ages often explode because they've got appropriate tuition, often in scenarios that they don't experience on the outside, where, you know, there's one teacher to five kids rather than one teacher to 25 kids. And so often they can leave detention having, again, you know, gained a whole lot of educational capacities they didn't have. Beyond that, detention is not really constructive.
I do have one quick question just to clarify. You mentioned earlier youth justice conferences as an alternative to, say, the court process. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. Youth justice conferences were introduced in New South Wales in the late 90s as a way to divert young people from children's courts into a process that brings victim and offender together. So it builds on a restorative justice model that says, to repair the harm from an offence, we actually have to better engage with victims who often don't feel particularly engaged through a court process. So young offender, victim, in the presence of perhaps a police officer and some support people and a convener and maybe some other affected members in the community, sit down, literally in a circle, talk it out. The young person's required to explain why they offended. The victim tells the young person what impact it had on them. The young person and the victim together then develop an outcome plan. That outcome plan essentially identifies what the young person will do to make amends. Sometimes that's just an apology. There often is great satisfaction from victims hearing a young person kind of be remorseful and apologise for their behaviour. Sometimes it involves doing some community work. Sometimes it involves the young person doing some work on themselves. And, you know, in the best of situations, often it's meant the victim and the young offender agree to do something after the conference together. That can be doing some community work together, or it can be a victim who owns a business invites the young person to work for them. So both parties leave having a greater understanding of what happened and each other, and ideally a kind of greater commitment to not getting to that same situation again.
Have you noticed it being used a bit more recently?
It's fluctuated over time. So the Youth Justice Conference numbers per annum were probably higher when the Young Offenders Act started in the late 1990s. There has been a bit of a push to try and increase the numbers again in recent years, but getting a conference right is a bit of a fine art form. You want to have a conference for a matter that ideally works as a conference. Victimless crime is not so useful because, you know, who represents the kind of perspective of a victim if there really isn't a victim? So I don't think we want to see too many conferences. I think we want to see well-run conferences for appropriate matters and them having good outcomes. You actually want a youth justice conference to be emotional. You want it to be perhaps a little bit, to be a little bit of conflict and tension, because the resolution of that through the process is really quite important if you have people leaving a conference agreeing to kind of stay in touch and to tell their friends and neighbours about the process and try and work together for some local solutions to particular youth crime problems. That's a wonderful outcome that you almost never get from a relatively impersonal court experience. It requires a level, to some extent, of linguistic and kind of psychological capacity, and that can be really tricky because for a lot of the young people, you know, if they're 13 or 14 years of age, sitting in a room full of adults, having to explain why they did what they did when they don't really have that good a handle on why they did what they did, can be incredibly confronting. So it can be constructive, but it can also be a difficult process for young people to engage with.
What you were just saying about the linguistic ability. So that's something you've been looking into more recently. Could you elaborate just a bit on that?
Yeah, so recently some colleagues from Allied Health Sciences who have got backgrounds in speech pathology and I undertook a small project for Youth Justice New South Wales, just attempting to understand what the literature says about the linguistic capabilities of young people who receive apprehended domestic violence orders, bail conditions, and who pass through children's courts, with the view to thinking about how processes associated with criminal justice are kind of child-friendly and how much they recognise the fact that for many young people in the youth justice system, they haven't had positive experiences at school, they haven't necessarily acquired lots of capacity to read English or to understand kind of concepts and constructs. So we're hoping to be able to undertake a longer-term piece of work that will actually interview young people passing through children's courts and police stations to get a sense of how much they do or don't understand legal concepts like bail, apprehended domestic violence orders, control orders, probation orders. There's a variety of legal concepts that actually are quite difficult to communicate, particularly to kids who we know have often high levels of intellectual disability and low levels of English attainment. There are great efforts that magistrates and others go to explain simply, but nonetheless, often concepts are difficult to communicate. If a young person's on bail and one of the conditions is residers directed, what does that mean for a young person that resides across three homes? How do we make sense of that? And do we then encourage the young person to be breached because they just simply didn't know how to comply with the order? We're very conscious of the high level of young people being remanded in custody whilst they await a court appearance. Could we address some of that by improving the language, the concepts, maybe the use of pictures, maybe the use of videos to have young people better understand the kind of foundational concepts of our criminal justice system that might be commonly understood by you and I, but may not be for a kid whose language ability is half their actual age and who in the heat of the moment is confused, anxious, excited, overwhelmed. And that's the point that they're having these concepts read out to them or explained to them. So we're particularly keen to understand how these things are communicated in the context of the system.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure, thank you.
What are the impacts of imprisonment on young people? Now that we've talked about what the age of criminal responsibility refers to and the causes of youth offending, in this section, Vivian and I will be discussing the impacts of youth imprisonment on children and indeed the impact on society as a whole. Vivian, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
What impact does being locked up have on these kids?
Obviously, a huge mental impact. In fact, the younger the children are when they first encounter the criminal justice system and are locked up, the more likely they are to reoffend. And also, they're more likely to not finish their education, which leads to lesser chance of finding employment, perpetuating a cycle of disadvantage. It definitely exacerbates the mental and physical health problems, especially because so many of those children come from disadvantaged backgrounds already. Especially because prisons are not adequately equipped to deal with all of the kids' needs.
So it does obviously have a massive impact on these kids and a massive cost to young people. What about the impact on society as a whole?
So when we think of the criminal justice system, I think most people think of it as this place that's far removed from society. These dangerous people are locked up and it has no effect on us whatsoever. But in fact, we are paying for all of it through tax. In fact, kids are so expensive, 4 times more expensive than an adult to lock up, costing around $531,000 a year to keep children under 14 in detention. And that's because kids require so much specialist supervision.
What is the total cost to Australia per year for children in detention?
So the full cost is $500 million a year for children detention. And even when kids are let off without a custodial sentence, resources are spent on lawyers and courts, which are all costing taxpayers of Australia. So it's having a huge impact on society.
Okay, no, that that is a lot of money. So basically, it's quite common for children's lives to be ruined effectively because of something silly they did when they were quite young for not even a particularly serious offence.
Yeah, definitely. And especially because kids, when you're 10 years old, like, do you really know what you're really doing? They don't have the mental maturity to really think about the consequences. So I think it's quite a harsh.
No, definitely. I mean, I'm 26 and I still don't really know what I'm doing. So at 10, you know, would have been much worse, I assume.
Yeah.
Okay, so clearly the current system does have a number of issues. What other options are there?
So I think instead of the focus on punishment in the criminal justice system, there's obviously a lot of programs that can be built to break the cycle of disadvantage and focus more on preventative measures. For example, there was this justice reinvestment program in Bourke, called the Maranguka Justice Reinvestment Program. It was implemented in 2016, and it's based on this idea of collective impact, bringing together a group of actors from community members to government and NGOs, and they all come together to solve complex social problems such as high incarceration rates. This is based on the idea that collective impact is more long-lasting than an individual just coming in and hoping for the best. They've identified several justice circuit breaker programs, such as the need for a learner driver program and providing free driving lessons for people in Bourke, especially because driving licenseless is a huge problem in the outback. And in fact, the Commonwealth government is committing over $35 million over 5 years to support 10 communities. And hopefully we'll be seeing the impacts of that way longer in terms of breaking the cycle of disadvantage and reducing the incarceration rates in these small towns.
No, great. Though, of course, $35 million is a lot less than $500 million, the total cost currently of keeping all those kids in detention.
Yeah, definitely.
So perhaps there's a lot more the Commonwealth could do.
We hope that we've shed some light on the key issues surrounding the age of criminal responsibility in Australia in this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.